Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 2, Episode 3, titled What is Dead May Never Die. That has something to do with the Greyjoys, right?
Yeah.
That title?
It does.
It's not their words. I know what their words are.
It's more their religious creed.
Yeah. It's more about that baptism scene with Theon that we get. What'd you think of this episode?
I liked it. I thought there was some pretty good political stunts. You know, Tyrion's infamous canary in the Red Keep trap for his closest advisors. I really liked Yoren's death scene. He went out in a suitably badass fashion. I liked it. What'd you think?
Yeah, I thought it wasn't, I don't know, quite as good as the previous two, although there were highlights, like you said. It's that Yoren scene is really good, and then Tyrion setting that trap for Pycelle was also really, really good. But everything else was kind of like, meh, okay.
I felt like it wasn't so much meh as there's like three scenes that really brought down the episode. Anytime Shay gets on scene,
yeah,
it's
oh
terrible. And when you throw in terrible Shay with Sansa at her most petty and terrible, it's hard to fucking watch. And then I honestly thought all of Renly's court intrigue was laughable. Like, it felt this show has made kind of Renly and Loras' relationship into a bit of a joke, I feel like.
Yeah, I don't really understand Loras all that much. Like, maybe he's a little jealous that Brienne's a better fighter than him.
Right.
And that she got appointed to the Kingsguard, but come on.
Yeah, I mean, like, in the books, Loras is a very talented, noble warrior who's also gay, where in the series, he's gay! And it's a lot of it is about
is
him.
Is he?
I mean, I just feel like that they really emphasize... Well, on the other hand, believe it or not, Renly's Kingsguard is called the Rainbow Guard because their cloaks are all different colors. So
okay.
Maybe George isn't so blameless in that. But I don't know. It just feels like it's a little... what would you call that? Shit. What's salacious, just for salaciousness sake?
Okay. Yeah, I guess I wasn't getting that from this episode, but
I don't know, just like Margaery and like, you know, oh, I get my brother in and just like throwing in another brother sister. I don't know. I know that this wasn't my opinion the first time through the series. It's just now that I've read more of the books and I've gotten a better appreciation for, like, you know, kind of the Reach and the High Gardens and it feels like some of this stuff is a little bit more trivial. But they are also really pushing hard this Knights of Summer, like how youthful and inexperienced and kind of non-serious they are. And one way to do that on film very quickly is to have a bunch of stuff that's maybe as an audience member you wouldn't take serious, like this gay king trying to conceive a child and his wife is a little too into the whole thing with her brother. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe that's just the phase that this season of Game of Thrones is in, because you also see, like, you know, Theon and some of his stuff is a little bit much at times, like with his sister and his father, and you gave me away, like a little melodramatic there from Theon, but I don't know. It's mostly working for me, and I think the stuff that doesn't work, Shay, is masked pretty well by how good the Tyrion stuff is.
Yeah.
Because it's really excellent in this episode.
Also, this is the debut of Gwendolyn Christie's Brienne of Tarth, which I think is magnificent. She's one of my favorite characters, and I think she's awesome. It's also funny because this weekend I marathon Top of the Lake, and she has a big starring role opposite of Elizabeth Moss in that. And it's fun to see her, because I've seen her in, well, I haven't seen her in Star Wars.
I haven't seen her face in Star Wars.
She purports to stomp around in some shiny chrome armor, but I still haven't seen her. I've heard her, but I haven't seen her. And so I haven't seen her in much that's not, you know, her grim warrior character in this. And it was. If you want to see more Gwendolyn Christie, check out the new season of Top of the Lake on Hulu.
Okay.
Hey, I want to do some housekeeping. First, if you're an American, today is National Voter Registration Day, and you can go to their website at nationalvoterregistrationday.org. It's a not-profit, nonpartisan guide to get you registered to vote, because you know, we have a midterm election coming up in 2018, which is historically underrepresented in democracy, and that's where a lot of really important things get filled. That's where you vote for your school board, and you vote for like local politicians, people that have a disproportionately large effect on your life. People don't pay attention and notice those. And also, there's a trend in this country, right or wrong, you can debate. They're tightening the requirements to get registered to vote, and you might not be keeping up on those, especially if you just moved to a state. And if you go to that website, nationalvoterregistrationday.org, they have a tool that will allow you to register for all 50 states. A lot of them will let you do it online, but they'll get you the forms that you can just print off and mail in so you're ready to go, because no one wants to show up to poll day and find out they've been accidentally disenfranchised. That would suck. What's going on at baldmove.com? So much stuff. We've got a bevy of first-run movies. We did Kingsman 2, The Golden Circle last week. This week is American Made, the Tom Cruise CIA drug-running crazy Iran-Contra movie. We also, Cecily and I saw It over the weekend, and we're going to do a podcast on that because we missed it when it first came out. We did a commission podcast on the 1992 Quentin Tarantino movie Reservoir Dogs. We've got American Horror Story coming out every week. Bald Move TV, we got a bunch of stuff to talk about. We might be over stuff. We got Star Trek Discovery, Top of the Lake, BoJack Horseman, maybe some Rick and Morty. We're double stuffed. We might need to do like two episodes in a row or something. I don't know. And then don't forget in October, because we're almost there, we're going to be seeing the debuts of Mr. Robot, Walking Dead, and Stranger Things.
Quadruple stuffed.
Oozing out, just like the Oreo said, we can't in good conscience release this Oreo. It's too stuffed. But yet we said, fuck you, Nabisco. We're going ahead full throttle with the quadruple stuffed, and we'll see. We'll see. Listening to Bald Move might cause coronary disease and all kinds of things. But you're a risk taker, I can tell. You listen to Game of Thrones coverage off season. That's as risky as it gets. Mm-hmm. You can find all that stuff at baldmove.com.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Should we get into the recap?
Why not?
All right, we start off with Craster returning to his house with John in tow, and he demands that all the Night's Watch leave. Gior sends John outside, and then he follows up to ask what happened. John tells him, hey, Craster's killing all the boys, but then he realizes, oh, Gior knows, and he's cool with it because Craster helps them out from time to time. I guess this is how this has got to go, right? Like, Gior doesn't come up here and fraternize with Craster without kind of knowing the score.
I think that's the shocking thing, right? Like, yeah, that was one thing that we were debating. Like, what is a guy in a position of – and to find out that he knows this and he's that real politic.
It's certainly shocking to John, and I think it was shocking to me, but it really shouldn't have been, because that's just kind of how it has to go.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like,
they've had too much interaction with Craster in the past, as far as I'm aware, to not know, hey, there's something up with the boys here.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's like it's also a statement of the real world, because in the real world, you lay down a lot with dogs and try not to get fleas, and it's just very hard not to do. And a lot of times, that stuff, like, you know, arguably what won World War II for us was the alliance with Soviet Russia. And then, like, was that a bad move because they become our most bitter enemies? Was it a bad move to empower Mujahideen in Afghanistan to fight the Russians and kind of vengeance for them supporting North Vietnamese and Vietnam? And then they turn out blowing up our towers on 9/11? Like, yeah, like it's none of this stuff is a good idea in the long run, but mm-hmm. in the short run, your Rangers are freezing, yo, and you need a roof over their head. So I honestly don't even know how to come down on this because it's terrible, it's awful, but sometimes it's shit you have to do. And then I think I can already hear the idealists listen to the podcast say bullshit. That's how you become diminished and lesser as a people.
Sure.
Well, okay, then your Rangers are going to freeze to death.
Yeah, well, now maybe what? We could do with a few less Rangers.
Maybe.
If the rest of the people are nicer.
Maybe we shouldn't even be north of the wall.
Yeah,
have you ever thought about that? Maybe we need to stop this interventions into the wildlings' affairs. Like, I get it. So you take Gior's position, and you run the Night's Watch for a couple decades and see if you've resisted the call of Craster's Keep.
And the big complication here is the Grumpkins and Snarks, right? The others.
Yes.
They're a real thing. We've seen them before.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows what kind of arrangement Craster's actually got with them? You know, he's right. obviously giving the male children to them for what purpose? We don't know. There could be other circumstances that John or even Gior doesn't understand.
Yeah,
right. And I think they do a little bit to salvage Gior. They say that yes, he understands that this is not like a completely awesome thing that Craster is doing by giving John the sword back at the end, right, and saying don't lose it again. It to me said, look, I know this is not right, but this is how it's got to be.
Yeah.
Instead of just like, this is how it is, deal with it. It's more like, I know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a great scene and it's a frustrating scene because life is frustrating.
For sure. Let's get over to Sam. He's giving Gilly a thimble that his mother gave him so she can keep it safe until he returns. I guess he used to read to his mom and this is the thimble she used to sew with. But his dad, when he found out about that, put the kibosh on it real quick.
Yep. None of this Rinley and Laura shit in my house, Sam.
Reading books
and taking an interest in sewing. Yeah,
no shit.
His dad Randall's a bit of a piece of work.
He sounds like it. Anything else on that scene?
No, but before we leave it, I forgot to update our Where Are My Dragons count. To the extent that there was no Danny in this episode, it still stands at zero. But someone, Sarah Z, wrote in and said, I think I may have an answer onto where my dragons count and why it's so inflated in people's mind. Having just rewatched all of season 2, I counted Danny saying that only one time in a show, but it was every fucking previously on between the episode and getting the dragons back. No wonder everyone remembers it.
Yeah.
Maybe because I'm not even watching it previously on. So, like, it, you know, obviously we're a third of the way through the season and still know Where Are My Dragons.
Yep.
We shall see.
All right, we go over to Hodor, who goes to wake Bran. And Bran seems to be having some kind of visions of being a wolf, potentially, which he tells Maester Luwin about, and how old Nan told him the stories about these people who could live in birds and wolves and all kinds of animals. And Luwin just dismisses them as dreams and assures Bran that magic doesn't exist anymore. Maybe at one time did, but no longer.
Yeah, I like the reveal that Luwin, like, he finds common ground with Bran here. Like, hey, I was kind of like you, you know, look at this here. Valyrian steel chain link.
Yeah.
Which, you know, he says that it's rare for a maester to take attention to that. Like, what, 1 out of 100 actually do? But it's like them dabbling in the dark arts, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, look, I was all about it, and I studied it, and I wanted it, and it's no longer a part. Like, maybe it once was, but it no longer is now.
First of all, I think Maester Luwin's just showing it off because he takes any opportunity to show off his links.
Yeah.
Like, if I spent my entire life and all I got for it was these stupid links, I would be showing them to everyone.
Right. And this is the one I got for winning the game of Barrel of Monkeys. Right. It's shaped like a plastic monkey because that's how you play the game.
And then, secondly, this is the mystery link?
Mm-hmm.
He calls it the mystery link for studying the mysteries? How many mysteries are there? Like, 3? Or are there thousands? Like,
I think the mysteries is the Citadel's polite way of dismissing the magic shit.
Okay, so like the conspiracy theory link, yeah. Essentially.
Yeah.
I mean, I just imagine there have to be many, many, many mysteries in this world, and Mr. Lewin to study them all is impressive.
Yeah, you get a link that's shaped like Stanley Kubrick wearing a spacesuit if you study the conspiracy link.
Yeah,
I also really like the Wolfgang POV where like you can see it from Summer's eyes, like Hodor's delighted to see him, but then there was like a scullery maid that's kind of like, oh, direwolf, and this is just like you know, someone went through at like knee or like crotch height with a camera and filmed that through this Winterfell set, and that amuses me.
Yeah,
some B director was really, 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 really directing shit out of that fake wolf and the people around him.
Yeah, and waking up to that wolf, I imagine would be scary to anyone else.
Yeah, probably would.
But to Bran, it's more like they're connected.
It's Monday.
Yep. All right, Renly's holding a gladiatorial battle when Catelyn arrives at his camp. The winner of the fight is a woman named Brienne, who asks to be part of Renly's Kingsguard. Renly agrees, and then Catelyn approaches Renly, who promises to avenge Ned and bring her Joffrey's head. Loras and Brienne kind of cop an attitude with Catelyn, but she just fires right back with some insults of her own. Renly takes Catelyn on a tour of his camp and then sends her off to her tent. A lot of stuff happens here. Yeah, so this is... Is this the first sighting of Margaery and Brienne?
I believe so, yeah. Okay. Margaery of House Tyrell.
Yeah, who is the knight Loras' brother, or sister,
yep.
Who was fighting Brienne.
And we also learn in this scene that the Tyrell's the real powerhouse behind Renly Baratheon. It's, you know, that they're providing the majority of the money and manpower, and they're getting the queen in return.
Yeah.
If Renly support works.
That seems to be the noble currency, is queens and princes and princesses. And
it's like vagina. It's the coin of the realm. He just passes it back and forth. And, you know, what is Myrcella and, Marjorie's a bad example because she wants the queen to be a queen and have that power as bad as anybody wants a traitor for it. So she's all about it.
She seems to be all about this little battle that's happening here with her brother involved, rooting for him vociferously. And Brienne sort of has an attitude with Catelyn, which I thought was funny because she's like super newly appointed Kingsguard, right? Mm-hmm. She comes in like, you're Kingsguard now. Catelyn steps up and then misaddresses the king here. And she's like, you should call him... your grace instead of Lord.
And be on your knees, too,
right,
lady.
Just 2 seconds ago, you were a fucking nobody. Get out of here.
And also, there's some other character buildings that she's not just kind of a stick in the mud, but, you know, she clearly has strong feelings about protecting Renly. She doesn't like being called lady. They're telling a lot of her backstory just in little bits and pieces and like barbs that you overhear people throwing at her. Hard to be a female warrior and be taken serious in Westeros.
For sure, yeah.
In fact, I think she's like a singular example. I do know that in the North there are some fierce warrior women in House Umber, especially in Mormont, but down south where chivalry holds sway, highly unusual.
Depending on how far south you go, I think. Yeah. But that's the other thing. Like,
Are you flirting with a spoiler, Jim Jones?
No.
Because I have no idea what you're talking about.
No, if you go to Antarctica, there are no genders.
Ah, gotcha.
It's all gender neutral.
Penguins are very enlightened that way.
Yeah.
Although they do call themselves emperor penguins.
Right.
Gendered language much.
Empress penguins. We need
that's
both.
Right. That's right. Or just imp.
Imp
with
penguins.
Just leave out the, because who knows?
Then Tyrion gets offended. You can't win.
You're right.
It's actually just kind of hard to be a female in the world of Westeros in general. Because, like, Catelyn's here. She doesn't really want to be here, right?
Yeah.
This was not her idea. This was Rob's idea. He sent her over here.
Yeah.
It really had to do some talking to convince her. So I wonder how effective she's going to be. She seems to start off on a bad foot with Renly.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean,
he essentially sends her to her room.
Yeah, he's very dismissive of her, and she's like, "You've got the gall to throw shade at my son, who's fighting for his life against a deadly opponent, and we are affording you this chance to hold festivals, and you know, essentially you stalling because you can't impregnate your bride, kind of thing."
Right.
She's not having it. She's not having it. Kat, I don't know if you noticed, kind of prickly. Could you take offense? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Might just snatch you up and arrest you on some kind of pretense and throw the realm into chaos with very little provocation.
Yeah, she might. All right, let's go over to the Greyjoys. Theon's pissed at Yara for not telling him who she was when they first met. That conversation is kind of cut short when Balon comes in and says the armies are spread out, leaving ample opportunity for them to reave and pillage in the north, which is exactly what they're going to do. He sends Yara with 30 ships to attack. Is it called Deepwood Mott?
Yep, Deepwood Mott.
I didn't turn on the subtitles, and that's what I thought they said, but I wasn't sure. But Theon gets a single ship named the Sea Bitch to raid the fishing villages on the shore, which I thought was pretty hilarious. He does not. He thinks it's a slap in the face, and he suggests that they pledge fealty in exchange for Casterly Rock. Balon says, "We do not so," and then he tells Theon that he's gone soft living with the Starks.
Mm-hmm.
And Theon whines, essentially, like, "You gave me away. I didn't have a choice." He's not wrong.
His tone is
a little much for me.
He's dead on, and you know, like, that's the thing. Balon is fucking... I think Balon is a terrible king for the Iron Islanders, and we can talk about his... There's a piece of feedback asking for historical background to the Greyjoys that I'm going to get into there, but... I mean, he is what has he paid the iron price for? And when he's tried it, how has it gone for his people?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's gutted his family. So I think Theon is dead on. But
he is, and you can see it on Balon's face. That
he has no response. All he does is essentially silence him. He
slaps him, and then he stares into the camera.
Yeah, yeah. Not an effective retort.
No, but Theon doesn't come off great in this scene either because he's kind of whiny, you know. "Oh, you should have told me about you being my sister. Ah, I want more than one ship. Ah, you gave me away." Like, just over and over, Theon's complaining instead of, I don't know, I guess just getting hard like an Iron Islander should be.
Right.
Anything else about this scene? Or
No, just the Deepwood Mott is the home of House Glover, and it's on the west coast of Westeros, kind of in the middle of the north, and it kind of acts as it's right off Bear. It's very close to Bear Island in that little bay, and it's named, like, the weird name it's got is because Mott is actually a construction technique. It's a way to form an earthen mound or, like, defensive fortification that you then put, like, a wooden fort on. So, a lot of northern keeps, don't think King's Landing. Think more of, like, those weird forts you used to see, like, the Eastern Europeans would come and build, and, like, they'd have, like, you know, wooden palisades, is what they call them.
Right.
So that's what they're talking about taking, and then using that as a central point to launch up and down, you know, raping and reaving expeditions.
Yeah, and this scene, I guess, makes you wonder how much Theon's loyalties lie with his family of the Greyjoys versus family of the Starks.
Yeah.
And Balon's questioning that the entire way.
Yeah, and we see that, like, you know, there's a scene at the end that kind of definitively, he makes a definitive decision, but I think they did a good job of showing the conflict. And the fact that he's not just going against... It's weird because he's asked to choose between his blood and the people who raised them, who has the plan that actually makes sense.
Right. Yeah.
And it must be very frustrating that, like, you could get all the glory and riches that you want if you support this guy. This other one, not only are you going to destroy a lot of people I care about, but also it's probably not going to go well for us.
Yep. Okay. Then we go to King's Landing, where Shay is feeling cooped up. Tyrion says she can become a kitchen wench if she'd like, but she's not happy about that. Tyrion tries to impress upon her the danger of the situation they're in, but Shay is too caught up in the precise words that he uses to get his larger point. This is the thing. That is the fundamental thing that I dislike about Shay, is that she is so concerned with the details of the language he uses. And I guess the perceived sentiment that she has versus, like, Tyrion's very real understanding of the danger that they are both in.
Yeah, I was trying to find ways to be more charitable with Shay, because I was like, I think what this is more about, I mean, obviously she's not too stupid to understand what she's doing here.
Of course not.
I think the thing is that she's trying to make the point that these are all things for Tyrion's sake. Like, Tyrion is afraid that she'll be killed. Like, she is not afraid, and she wants to be defiant, and she wants Tyrion to stand up to her, his old man. And because she, I don't know why, because she doesn't know Tywin Lannister the way Tyrion knows Tywin Lannister.
Right, that's the big problem here, is Shay just doesn't get it. She doesn't know the situation she's in. She thinks defying your father is like a thing you can do without repercussions.
Right. You think my father wanted me to be a whore? No, I just marched out and I said, well, I'm on a whore, daddy. And
yeah, guess what? Your father didn't have fucking armies and all the gold in the world to come after you if you defied him.
Yes.
Defy him. Like,
yes.
It's a fundamentally different daddy.
Yeah, and like the power and scale and how relative. Like, I don't know that she doesn't understand. I honestly don't get that fact. I don't get Shay, because they portray her as simultaneously intelligent but also pig-headed about this kind of stuff. And maybe I mean, I think that the easy thing to say is that Tyrion should cut her loose. Because what's important to him is obviously not important to her. Like, she wants, he loves her and wants her to survive. She doesn't give a shit. And so, like, it's not, but I think what she's wanting is honesty from him. Mm-hmm. Like, don't make this about me. Make this about you and your, like, you know, like I'm defined as your weakness. Like, that is kind of fucked up. I get what she's saying. But on the other hand, there is no happy ending for this.
No, there can't be. I mean, it start
unless Tyrion is literally going to depose his father and win over House Lannister as the third born dwarf son. That's the only way this thing has a happy ending.
Yeah,
and also, you know, he doesn't need. I mean, he's supposed to be like. Here's the other thing about Tyrion. You know, talking about his flaws, he brought Shay to the house or to King's Landing to stick it to his father.
Yeah, that's what I was going
to
say.
But he's there to fucking rule. Mm-hmm. And how is she helping him do that? Like,
she's not. It's in some ways a contradiction, because Tyrion shouldn't have her there. He's only doing it for a bad reason.
Right. And she's also a giant lever, with the fulcrum being in his asshole, that if anyone gets the end of that stick, they can just leverage him any way they want.
Right.
Because, again,
and he's
she's
lucky it wasn't Littlefinger who found her out. He's lucky it was Varys who's willing to play his game for the time being.
Or Pycelle, because Pycelle turns out over to Cersei, and now Cersei's going to be able to snatch her up. And it's just like he's got to play this other game that is completely unrelated to his success at defending King's Landing. It's really frustrating on the rewatch. Like, come on, Tyrion. I love you to death, but
yeah. I mean, it's supposed to be frustrating.
Right.
Like, Tyrion's a very smart character, but what he's doing here is very dumb.
Right.
And it's very petty for bad reasons he's doing these things.
Duties of hand before hose. That's basic Lannister
hand.
Bro code, right?
Sure.
You got to get those distractions out of there.
Yeah. I guess maybe it's in the delivery. They both are doing stupid things for stupid reasons, but Tyrion's just much more entertaining for me to watch.
Yeah.
He's a much more charismatic character, I would say.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we actually get to see him do amazing things, and, like, you know, I guess it's a fair question to ask what could Shay actually do that's amazing. We'll see. But yeah, it's grating. It's pretty bad.
All right, Sansa's dining with Cersei and her two youngest children, Marcella and Tommen. Marcella brings up the topic of her wedding to Joffrey, and Sansa pretends to be happy about it, though it's very obvious on her face she's not. And things just get more awkward from there, with Tommen asking about the death of her brother, and, like, yeah, it's just not a good scene. Not a good scene at all. Mm-hmm. I don't mean the scene in the show is bad. The scene in the show is fine. But this whole topic is a bad idea.
Yeah. And
Cersei almost seems to revel in it. She's sticking it to Sansa.
Yeah, and it, like, that's the thing. Like, you feel so bad for Sansa because she's being forced to do this. And then her new handmaiden Shay walks in.
Yeah.
And right. Sansa is just, Jesus Christ, the mm-hmm. worst.
Yeah.
And I get it. That's a normal human reaction. I've seen it time and time again. You experience oppression, and the second you get the upper hand, you want to pay that back. Like,
yeah.
you would think it's the opposite. Like, getting a taste of that would make you realize how bad it feels, so you don't want to make anyone feel that bad. But no, Sansa's yet to learn that lesson, apparently.
I'm putting myself in her shoes, and I'm saying, okay, I've got a bad situation here, right? My father's been beheaded. I'm living in a castle I don't want to live in with a husband-to-be that I don't want as a husband.
Right.
Things are pretty shitty. I would have hoped that I would at least get a good handmaiden out of all this.
Yeah, and now like, I don't even
not
have someone
the greenest.
To brush my hair properly.
Right. I wanted the fancy dresses and the nice hair,
Marcella's
and I got it,
get
but...
two fancy dresses for my one ivory.
Right.
Not fair.
Not at all. So I feel for you, Sansa.
And I don't. And the other thing, from Shay's perspective, is like she's got the biggest fucking attitude
yeah.
about this
mm-hmm.
position. That is, you know, it's like I'm not unsympathetic for her. It's bullshit. She wanted to be brought
yeah.
in, and you know, Tyrion promised her silks and perfumes and gold things and King's Landing and what a big adventure and blah blah. And she's getting this bullshit. But
yeah.
still, you know, she has. I don't. Do you think that she just doesn't take Tyrion seriously when he says how dangerous this is for him and her?
That's the only conclusion I can come to.
Yeah.
Because if she realized the danger that they were in, I don't think she would be acting the way she is.
I just don't understand why she doesn't, because she's been positioned as an intelligent prostitute, mm-hmm. and she's lined with many powerful military men, and
mm-hmm.
she's heard stories. Like, you've got to heard a few stories about Tywin Lannister. It really doesn't make sense.
Yeah. I don't know. All of that adds up to kind of that being my least favorite character.
Yeah.
That we've got on screen at the moment.
Yeah.
So let's go over to Pycelle, who gives Tyrion a laxative.
The gift of a proper shit.
Yeah, I think this is all just an excuse, though, for Tyrion to set this canary trap with Pycelle and Varys and Littlefinger by telling each of them that he's marrying Marcella off to three different suitors. It's, I guess, interesting to see how each reacts. Varys almost, like, can tell what he's doing. Like, I read Varys' face and I go, Varys has done this before.
Mm-hmm.
This is not
Ooh,
his first time around the
mustn't
block.
No. Like, yeah, right? He's like, he's so Elam Garrick from Deep Space Nine, which
yeah,
is one,
yeah.
why I love him so much, because Elam was one of my favorite characters, and he's playing it almost exactly the same way. I agree.
Yep.
I thought that, like, oh, someone's picked up Spycraft 101.
Yeah.
Going to teach the Master of Spiders a thing or two about tracking down a leak, eh?
Uh-huh.
Do tell.
And Pycelle's too dumb to understand what's happening.
Right.
And then Littlefinger is just all about himself. He's concerned with what do I get out of it.
Right.
Kind of very telling for all these different characters, like
right.
how they react to this.
Right.
Which makes it such a great scene, because everybody's acting how you expect everybody to act. And Tyrion, Peter Dinklage is just destroying the screen here.
Uh-huh.
Like, I watching Peter Dinklage act in this scene is just a pleasure.
Because mm-hmm.
he's having fun with it, you can tell.
And the way it's constructed, where it's just like,
yeah.
it's like Groundhog's Day, but the only thing that changes is who's Marcella gets wedded off to. I
uh-huh.
like that. It looked like it was fun for everybody, and
yeah.
even Littlefinger. Like, I don't think Littlefinger is quite as on the take as Varys, or maybe he's just better at hiding it. But like Littlefinger sees the problems with the thing that is being proposed.
Yeah.
And also sees the danger of, like, being Tyrion's follower, because he has just really been cleaning house.
Yeah, with Janos, he points that out.
Yeah. So, I don't know, because the other thing about Varys and the Spycraft is, it's super entertaining for us as the audience to see him kind of, like, smile and simper in Tyrion's face. Probably
mm-hmm.
not the smartest play to make, though.
I felt like Tyrion got it, though. Like, Tyrion understood that he knew what was up.
Yeah, but is that the smart play? Like, wouldn't it be better to, like, just go along and, like, oh, my, how amazing, and, like, you know, let, like, I just feel like Varys is best suited for people underestimating him.
Okay.
Again,
yeah.
Super entertaining for us to watch the game, but, like, if I'm playing a game, it'd probably be better to keep a poker face and your cards a little bit closer to your vest.
Unless you're trying to be this guy's friend, right? I mean, is that Varys' goal? Because he said...
And we see by the end of the episode, he has successfully,
yeah.
of the three... advisors in opposition to him, ingratiated himself to Tyrion.
Yeah, so maybe that's part of his
yeah,
plan.
Yeah, here I'm trying to give political lessons to the master of whispers and spiders.
Yeah, we'll just let Varys be Varys.
How arrogant of me.
Okay, we go to Renly and Loras, who are banging in his tent, but Loras can't get Brienne off his mind. He's jealous, I guess. He also says that Renly's men are starting to laugh about he and Margaery not having consummated their marriage yet. And Loras sends in Margaery to have sex with a now very drunk Renly. He's unable to go through with it, and Margaery reveals that she knows all about him and Loras, and that she's willing to do whatever it takes to get his baby in her belly.
Right.
Not where babies go, by the way. You don't want a baby in your belly. That means you've eaten a baby.
So it's funny because I kind of changed my mind on this scene from my initial reaction at the top of the show to now, because I got a lot of this like Loras being having hurt feelings that he was bested by Brienne and all this, but now I'm seeing that like what it is I think he's frustrated because Renly is not even trying to do what's necessary, which is keep their relationship a secret and impregnate his sister to keep the whispers at court at bay. And that frustration is coming out as jealousy and pique at the Brienne situation.
So you think Catelyn maybe got to him a little bit with that comment about just playing at war?
I think it's the fact that, like, yes, an outsider like Catelyn can take one look at this camp and kind of, like, see Renly's non-seriousness, and then that germ leads to, and oh, by the way, why is he maintaining the chastity of his queen? And oh, by the way, doesn't he spend a little bit too much time with the brother? And then, you know, once your power is undermined in this, and again, like, you know, is it bullshit that a gay king can't be a good king? Sure.
Sure.
Sure. But that's the way the society is set up, and Loras knows that, and Renly knows that, but Renly is doing the fun and easy things of being the king and not doing the serious ones.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether I just don't like Renly, because I do like Loras. I don't know that I like Renly, and I just don't. I'm seeing their relationship as bad because I just like the fact that it seems like Loras should be the one as king. Although I don't know, like
he doesn't have the claim.
He doesn't have the claim. Yeah. He doesn't have the claim, but he's always been the one that's more serious, and he's kind of like pushed Renly into this for his own ambition, and his frustration with this is kind of palpable.
Yeah. They did pick, in my mind, phenomenal Renly. Like, he looks like Robert Baratheon if he had like 50 more pounds on him.
Right. Yeah.
A lot like him.
And
like,
that's
he could
how
be
he's
his
always
brother.
Described as the book. Like, he is, he's, I think they refer to him as the, well, maybe as Robert, as the true steel. Because like there's this armorer that was talking about them in terms of steel, and like, you know, Renly was too flexible, and Stannis was too rigid and brittle, but like Robert was the true steel of the two, and he was the one who was able to keep the kingdom. You know, he's a bad king too, but he did keep that thing together for 20 years. And now we're seeing Renly; he just wants to please people, and you can't do that if you're a king.
Not all the time, no.
Right, he just wants Stannis and everybody to be like, well, look, this guy's got 100,000 guys, so obviously he's got the better claim, and we'll just let that happen without any bloodshed.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Right.
The other thing I wanted to talk about a little bit is Margaery, because I feel like there's an edge to Margaery that
there
I don't
sure
quite
is.
Understand yet, and it's displayed sort of in her apparent bloodlust during the tournament.
And I thought it was a good thing to show in contrast, well, not in contrast, but like kind of reinforcing her brother's attributes, because there was that scene where he's shaving Renly's chest and he cuts him and is like, you know, what's the fuss? This is just blood.
Yeah.
You're going to see a lot of it on your way. Like, her and Loras are of one mind. And one might think, huh, I wonder how they got that way. But they're like, they know what it takes, and they're fucking committed. They're in it to win it.
And it seems like they're in a perfect position to manipulate Renly into whatever they'd like.
Right.
You know? I mean, one of them is his I guess, public queen.
Yeah.
And one of them is his private lover. So, like, they kind of have both sides of him here.
Uh-huh.
And they can just squeeze from the middle. So, like, it should be like, oh, Margaery's trying to help out. Margaery understands how important this is. But something about Margaery's delivery or something says that she is maybe not in this for the exact reasons that she should be.
Hmm.
Or maybe she's like,
I think she's in it for personal ambition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I,
Which is, I think, what you should be. Like, if you're the queen, like, that's probably in this world.
Personal,
like,
ambition? I don't know. I mean, it should be like a mutual benefit,
okay,
sort of,
yeah,
thing, right?
You also want to help the realm out and you think you can do a better job and all that.
And she says it that way. She says, like, oh, Renly, I need, like, people are talking and, like, we need to do this because it's the right thing. But, like, something about the way she's saying it doesn't make me think that she's in it for Renly at all.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Okay.
Yeah, I buy that. I think that Renly is a means to an end.
Okay.
She, yeah, would, she
like,
would,
securing power.
She would queen up Stannis if he was available, or Rob, if, you know, but this is the play that her family's making, and they're both backing it with everything they got.
Maybe it's just her smile, because she has, like, the
she does have
most devious of smiles.
She's got this smug, I'm up to something at all times smile.
Yeah.
But it's also very disarming, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's trouble.
All right, we go over to more trouble. Cersei, who is super pissed that Tyrion is sending Myrcella off to Dorne, which tells Tyrion that his canary trap has worked. Tyrion says, too bad, and he tries to extol the virtues of sending her away, which is basically no rape or heads on spikes, but Cersei's not really interested in hearing that.
Yeah, I mean, he's like a couple steps ahead. He's like, I'm planning for the worst. Mm-hmm. I'm planning for a world in which we are deposed and we are in exile and we need allies and we, you know, we need to keep our chain of succession. We should and Cersei's just not hearing it, because I don't think she's even allowed herself to think of a world where her father gets beat on the battlefield and they have to consider these things.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I
guess my biggest question coming out of this scene was, what happens if Varys talks? Or what happens if Littlefinger talks?
Okay.
Does Myrcella get sent off to whatever place has the least loyal person with the information?
So Mike McSee was the first of many to ask that same question. He said, when Tyrion played the Lion Game, do you think he would have proceeded with any of the plans that had leaked, or did he have a hunch that the Grand Maester was the likely culprit? I think the latter, because Tyrion and Theon didn't jive during their brief encounter at Winterfell, and he saw firsthand that Sweet Robin was a breastfeeding disaster.
Mm-hmm.
Breastfeeding disaster. Thoughts? I guess the implication that you guys are going with is that Tyrion was going to have to follow whichever of these plans came to light. I don't think that's true. I think as soon as one of the plans came to light to his sister, he would have exposed the traitor and then done whatever. I do think that the Dorne was probably the one that made the most sense.
Yeah, I could see that.
Although,
so Cersei comes screaming like, "Oh, I'm super pissed that you're sending Myrcella up to the Reach or whatever."
Right? He'd say, "Well,
he'd say, no, I'm not doing that.
Fear not.
She's going to Dorne.
That's you've got bad advice," which would also make sense, probably. Yeah. I mean, because that suits his purpose too. Because then, when he does away with the person, Cersei can't really complain, can she?
Yeah.
Because, well, these guys, you know, spreading gossip and so I don't feel it's my and there's. It went the way it did, so this is all hindsight, and since it all worked to Tyrion's satisfaction, there's no explanation of, you know, what, like, he doesn't talk about all of his contingencies, but that's how I took it, that he was just, one of those was probably legit. What I think would have been made it more clear is if he had had three plans that neither of them, and then he had a fourth plan that he revealed once his canary trap was sprung.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that would have been, but that's not how it went down in the books. It's not how it went down in the show. So
yeah, it's fine the way it went down. I was just curious if you had any thoughts on it.
Yeah.
All right, we go to Theon writing a letter to Rob, warning him about the impending Greyjoy attack. I think, I don't know. I tried to read a little bit of it backwards.
It is.
With
it
his
said,
handwriting, and
it did. I paused it. It said something along the lines of, "Rob, hopefully this message gets to you before it's not too late. My father's planning on betraying you and taking the North. You should ride as fast, as soon as possible, blah, 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 and stop it."
Go to Deepwood Mott. Kill all my blood, I guess.
Yeah.
So he decides to burn it instead of sending it. And afterward, he's baptized into the Iron Islanders religion, which I don't know the name for, per se.
They worship the drowned god.
Okay. All right. I guess not all of, like, the Faith of the Seven is kind of like a proper name.
Yeah.
But, like, the drowned god doesn't really...
Drowned Godianity.
Uh-huh.
The drowned godhood. I do think that I love how this was staged. Like, Theon in that inky black room lit only by the candle and the letter burning was a fucking phenomenal visual of the darkness of him warring with his light side. I thought it was great. I thought his performance where he's just, like, deeply unsure about all this. Like, once he gets baptized, there's this moment where he stands as kind of his like kind of wild eyed looking around like, oh shit, this is really happening. There's not like I get this feeling that like he's waiting for something to stop what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not like only you can do that. And he's not strong enough to do it. So,
yeah, because he's one of those soft Starks.
He's a yep. That they're renowned for their softness.
Definitely not. But so how old are the kids that are usually baptized or kids? I assume they're kids. Are they usually Theon's age or younger?
I don't think
because I was trying to like picture this with a younger child and it came off really weird.
That's a really good question because I don't have a great answer for you.
Okay.
It's funny because the priesthood has one step more where they actually drown the person.
Yeah.
They actually drown them, and then I think they do that to the king as well. They drown them, hold them under until they drown. They take them out and do a primitive form of CPR, and if they come back to life, they literally rise stronger and harder. And if they die, well, drowned God didn't like him anyway, so just shove him into the sea. But yeah, I don't know if there's like a christening. Because that's the thing is like this is kind of a half-assed. Like, do you believe in a drowned God or not?
Right.
Like, what is this? Is this for the people that got one foot on the shore and one foot in the sea? Come on.
It's just, I guess, yeah, taste test of the ocean.
Yeah. You got a sprinkling. What is damp may never dry.
Nice. All right, let's move on to Littlefinger. He comes to Tyrion, who is pissed that he lied. Or, sorry, he is pissed that Tyrion lied to him about where Marcella is going. Tyrion proposes to make it up to him by having him help free Jaime and telling him he can see Catelyn Stark again. Bronn busts in saying, hey, we found him with company. And then they go bust into Pycelle's room where he's lying with a whore. Tyrion knows that he told Cersei and he gets Pycelle to admit that he had, you know, he didn't poison him, but he had a hand in Jon Arryn's death and has him hauled off to the Black Cells after cutting off his beard.
High comedy all around.
Yeah, pretty good. I enjoyed it. How weak and pathetic Pycelle sounds here. Like, I always serve the Lannisters. Like, no, come on, you served yourself.
Well, and that's the thing is, like, as I think someone sent this, I'm not sure if I read it, but someone pointed out that the essential corruption of Pycelle is that he does take sides. That is directly against his oath as a maester. Like, he is supposed to serve the institution of the king. Like, he's not supposed to, like, oh, I want my thumb on the scale and make sure the Lannisters are always on top. That's not what a maester is supposed to do. So Tyrion, like, you know, even though he's corrupt for his family, Tyrion's probably well shot of him.
Okay. Yeah. Seems right. I don't have a lot more to say about this. I like this how Tyrion like, comes back with the second gold coin after that, seeing this.
That had a huge second life as an upvote gif on the Song of Ice and Fire Reddit. Like,
I bet.
You know, that, like, it was a little orange upvote that he would put on there with that little smile. It was really good. And the whole, like, he's got his, like, you know, you might have forgotten that he's got these hill tribes still with him. And he's got, you know,
right.
I think it's Timot. And he's saying, you know, cut off his genitals and feed him to a goat, but there are no goats. Well, make do. Like, stuff is all really good.
It was. Then we go to Varys saying to Tyrion that Shae is doing well in Sansa's service, and he compliments Tyrion's plan.
The sheer force of will, he didn't add air quotes around the word well.
Yeah.
And service.
Varys puts a riddle to Tyrion about where true power lies, and Tyrion decides he doesn't like riddles. Essentially his point is power resides where men believe it lies. It's a trick, a shadow on the wall, and a very small man can cast a very large shadow. So I guess this is Varys, you know, saying yet again, I'm here to be your friend. Let's work together.
And this continues this season's meditation on power and where it resides. And I like this riddle because it's not answerable. It depends on, well, how rich, you know, it depends on how well loved the king is. It depends on what the king can believably promise to the sellsword. It's all highly variable. And to the extent that you can sell that, you know, is kind of like power is a fickle thing. And, but he also then spins it to Tyrion's advantage by saying this, you know, small man can cast a very large shadow, which Tyrion really likes.
Yeah.
He likes that image.
For sure. Then we go over to, I guess, the final series of scenes here. Arya can't sleep, and she asks Yoren how he can sleep with all the horrible things he's seen. He realizes she's talking about her father's death, and then he tells her about how he saw his brother stabbed through the heart, and he couldn't get the name of his killer out of his head. he finally saw the man again, and he murdered him before then going off to the wall, which is not exactly a lullaby, Yoren. Which he understands. He's like, yeah, I guess that didn't go anywhere good for you. And the Lannister troops show up, demanding the hand over Gendry. Yoren refuses, and a battle begins. Arya sees Jaqen burning and goes over to give him a sword, I guess? An axe or something? Yeah. The survivors are rounded up, and Arya says Gendry is the kid that they just killed with her sword. The one who is trying to make off with the real Gendry's bull helm, and the rest of them are carted off to Harrenhal, presumably. That's what the guard says.
Indeed. I think the previous scene where he's talking about Willem, he's advising her to, like, lean into it. Like, the way that, like, sure. Recently I've got this new technique where when I'm trying to sleep, I envision a white piece of paper.
Yep. Okay.
And, like, I just continually, like, as thoughts try to intrude, I continue to come back. He's like, well, if you can't get out of your mind, then fixate it. Make, like, this mantra, this prayer.
Yeah.
And he's like... It's not a panacea, because as he has a shocking realization that, like, I can't remember my own brother's death, the inciting incident, but I can remember everything about Willem. Mm-hmm. And we'll see how Arya puts this, because Yoren is one of the, Arya has had many mentors up to this point, and I don't think it's a spoiler to say she'll continue to have mentors along the way, and Yoren is one of the oft-forgotten ones.
Sure.
But, he saved her from King's Landing, gave her a little bit of wisdom, and then meets the end of his road here. Mm-hmm. Where she goes next, well, it's going to be Harrenhal.
Harrenhal, unless she escapes.
That's not a spoiler. But what happens there, there's also, we're supposed to see Jaqen take an interest in Arya as well. How is this going to pay off? Presumably for Arya's benefit, or maybe it'll be more dangerous, but we're supposed to notice that.
Or maybe he'll burn to death. Like, they don't actually show him getting out of that cart. So.
That would be hilarious. I would love a show to be, because that's like something George Martin would do in his books. Like, Arya would give an axe to someone significant, and then he's just never heard from again.
Right.
Presumably, he burnt to death in the wagon. Sorry. I might have had too much of a tell there. But,
The couple of kills that you see in this are pretty brutal.
Yeah.
Like, Yoren, like... Yoren's awesome. He takes
the thing
crossbow
about crossbows.
Bolt.
They're so slow to reload.
Yep. He takes a crossbow bolt. He takes, like, spears in the back and the side. And it finally, that'll definitely kill you.
Yeah.
Putting a sword all the way down your spine through your body.
Yeah, that's the Roman way to execute a soldier. Soldier's death.
That'll do it.
Yep.
And then the needle through the neck for that young kid who was a thief. Let's not forget that.
Right.
He was a little shit. He was trying to steal Gendry's bull helm, which got him killed.
Uh-huh.
Well, that didn't directly get him killed, but he got Gendry off
the hook.
His
attitude about being carried is what maybe if he had been a little bit more grateful.
Right. It was his fault. Totally his fault.
Well, you're the one saying, fucking me's a thief. You're not going to high road me from the low road, mister.
I say maybe just take his fingers.
All right.
Take his fingers, let him have his neck.
Fair enough. But he kills the guy whose name, I believe, is Lami, one of Arya's kind of friends she meets along the road.
Uh-huh.
And she's able to pin that on the Gendry head on the Lami.
Yeah, and then Gendry steps up and says, no, I actually really like that bull helm. I need to grab it.
It's all the same to you, since he's clearly dead.
Yeah.
I don't know. But Arya is a pretty traumatic scene. She loses one of her mentors. She loses Needle, even more importantly.
Yeah, and she's captured.
Yeah, she's captured. She's in the hands of the enemy forces. Now that's the thing. She's not. They don't know what they've got. They think they've killed Gendry, and they're going to bring these guys back for interrogation. But scary situation to be in.
She's pretending to be Ari.
Ari the boy.
Yep. That's it. It's the end of the episode.
Yep. Hey, guys, if you're enjoying our recap coverage of Game of Thrones Season 2, just know that the only reason it exists is because we're doing this as our full-time job, because otherwise we got way too much stuff to do to go back and rewatch a past season, even if something as successful as Game of Thrones. So the way that we keep going financially is primarily through our club. If you go to club...
Oh, I thought it was the... the fact that Bald Move is a drug front.
I wish I knew that. That would have been helpful.
I was going to tell you.
That's drug.baldmove.com. You have to have a tour. What is it? A tour client? I don't even know.
Yeah.
I'm a terrible criminal.
You got to pay in Bitcoin Cash.
You're right. I'm a terrible criminal, and also I'm wearing a wire. So I'm taking you down with me on this enterprise I knew nothing about. But you can go to our front, club.baldmove.com, to sign up for a low price. You get a ton of special features. You get video versions of our podcast that record live. There's no faster way you can get it. You get special audio and bonus video features. Like last week, we did a playthrough of episode 2 of Telltale's The Wolf of Wall Street.
Nope. The Wolf Among Us,
The Wolf Among Us. It's where I keep waiting for the one where we get to smash our Lamborghini because we're all high on Quaaludes. It hasn't come yet. But a lot of stuff like that where we have bonus. If you like listening to Jim and I talk about stuff, there's more of that for the club. Our first run movies, you get the spoiler free version free, but if you want the full spoiler, you got to be a club member, to say nothing of all the bonus features. And if you go to club.baldmove.com, they outline all those features, give you a little bit of sample, and again, the first 30 days are free to try, so check it out, club.baldmove.com. thanks in advance for your support.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't.
In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
What do we have for feedback?
We got a couple of interesting things. First off, a guy named, or maybe a woman, Zan S. He's got a friend that works for, this special effects house called Allura. I think that's how you pronounce it, I-L-O-U-R-A. And they have every season they come out with this like demo reel where they show like all the special effects that they contributed to Game of Thrones. And it is amazing. Like, this is all for season 7, so if you're just joining us on the rewatch, skip it. But if you want to see how some of the really breathtaking scenes from season 7 went in and how much compositing, like, I was surprised at how little was actually real. And then I was also surprised at how much stuff was based on reality with the fantastic
depending on
scenery.
The scene, yeah.
Yeah, so you can check that out. I got a link to it in the show notes. It's for public dissemination, so... Moving on to Allison S., one thing I talk about with my husband all the time is the Iron Island economy. It's the most baffling thing to me. The scene in the Nightlands with Baelin welcoming Theon home and his general disgust at his upbringing and appearance is the first we've really seen or been able to understand as a viewer the Iron Price. I know I probably need to read the books to learn more about it, but for now I'm like Jim, and as a show watcher only, I love hearing details about the books from my husband or your spoiler edition. My question is, what does an economy look like that you have to murder to obtain anything? I know the pirates do and did exist, but it's pretty unbelievable to me that the same family could have ruled this island with any kind of authority with this kind of society. Are there no skilled laborers on Pike? If they're good pirates, do they steal gold and then use it to buy goods or services? How would an iron price economy even work? It seems like it would crumble so easily and be a major liability to the realm at large.
Okay, let me try and explain it the way I understand it, and then you can correct me and tell me that way it actually is.
Okay.
If you know. The way I understand it is the Iron Price refers to essentially honor or respect amongst these people. So, like, you don't kill someone to get a loaf of bread. You don't have to pay the Iron Price for bread. You can pay gold for it. But, like, Theon is trying to dress as if he's this, you know, noble person and this person of great stature. But he hasn't paid the Iron Price for it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like the good itself that hasn't paid the Iron Price for. It's more like the respect that comes from wearing something like that hasn't been earned by him.
Yeah. I would say that, like, I think that, you know, the whole nature of them not sewing the Iron Price is almost like a religious text that can be interpreted differently by different people. And the story of the Iron Islands is the story of a people, especially since Aegon the Conqueror. Because here's the thing. Harrenhal used to be an Iron Islander. Like, the Iron Islands used to rule the Riverlands and the islands. Like, and they had a lot of money and a lot of power. And Harren the Black, who created Harrenhal, which he meant to be this impregnable fortress, which, by the way, he built with his own fucking hands. He did not pay the Iron... I guess that's kind of paying Iron Price for it. Aegon the Conqueror said, oh, you got an impregnable castle? I will just roast you fucking alive with my three giant dragons. Mm-hmm. And he did that, which is why Harrenhal is ruined and said to be cursed. Because the guy that built it died inside it. And then, you know, obviously the Iron Island became small again after that because, you know, they went against Aegon, the Tullys were given to Riverlands and they had to subside of the island. And the history, the 300-year history since is essentially a succession of kings saying, we should get back to the old ways of raping and reaving. And then the Targaryens putting their boot up their ass. And then a king saying, whoa, that's the wrong way to go. We should try to rejoin civil society and maybe try out the Seven Gods. And then they get complacent and the Viking comes up and says back to raping and reaving. And Balon Greyjoy is the latest revolution trying to go back to the old ways. And he got a Robert Baratheon-sized boot up his ass for his trouble. So it's not an economy that really works. And when the Iron Islanders, when they do get rich off that, inevitably they sit down and start building castles and wanting to become fancy lads themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right and you're wrong. Like, being a thief works, but then after you're a successful thief, what do you do? Like, do you keep living in the fucking sewer, or do you, you know, build yourself a mansion with your ill-gotten gains?
Right.
Anyway, hopefully that helped a little bit of background. B. Garrett says, I'm joining you guys on your review of Season 2. Speaking of things I may have missed, was there ever a connection shown between why the White Walkers take only the sons? Did you notice the New Zealand that crept? Was there ever a connection? Yeah, was there ever a connection? Was this specifically a deal made so that he can continue to produce more children, or were there something about being a male that attracted the White Walkers? I think that we should probably keep watching.
Okay, yeah, I don't know the answer to that question.
Because there are a lot of things not yet in evidence, and we know very little about the White Walkers at this point. So these are things that you are wise to theorize on and speculate about, but don't think it's time to reveal the answer just yet. Adam G., I've been rewatching this series with my dad, who has never seen the show or read the books, and I had a question come up that I did not know the answer to. When did Melisandre start with Stannis? When did she start? Don't you start with me, Melisandre. I'm starting with you, Stannis. Fine. Fuck it. We're started. Was she telling him that he was the prince that was promised before Robert died, or was this all after? Do you have any idea on that?
I had to
research this.
Yeah, don't know.
It's a good-ass question, I'd say. It's a good-ass question your dad proposed to you, Adam. So I did some research, and I found an interview that Martin did on the So Spake Martin archives at thecitadel.org that he did in Barcelona in July of 2012. Someone asked him, why did Melisandre seek out Stannis? Did she see him in her flames and decided to seek him out on her own, or is she on a mission on behalf of the Red Priest? It doesn't seem at any point that the latter is the case when you compare it to something else that's irrelevant. Anyway, George Martin said, you're absolutely right. Melisandre has gone to Stannis entirely on her own and has her own agenda. That's the official word that we have on this. Now, we'll eventually come to appreciate that the Red Priests do send envoys to kings because they're trying to sell the next great religion. And Melisandre is not a part of that official mission. That's what we know from Martin. But people have pieced together that she wanted an in with Stannis, so she approached his wife and converted her, the lady, the Selyse.
Okay.
And then used the power of the wife to...
And now she's banging Stannis.
To convert Stannis, and now she owns him lock, stock, and his barrel. So...
I gotta wonder how the wife feels about that.
maybe we'll find out.
Okay.
So far, we've only seen her on the beach looking excited about gods being burnt.
Yeah.
Josh L. from Denver. Before I express any thoughts on the Nightlands, might I make a humble suggestion? I think Dany only says the full, where are my dragons, once or twice, but you can count how many times she says just my dragons after the theft. I think the number would be rather high. So that happens a lot, too, where people misremember. For example, Ned Stark never says, brace yourself, winter is coming.
Okay.
Yet if you were just a Disney on the internet, you'd think he'd said it every fucking episode.
Mm-hmm.
So she might be bitching and moaning about her my dragons a lot, just not the whole full-throated where are my dragons.
Sure.
Okay, James H. Is it possible there are more lands south of Westeros and Essos? If the two continents are situated on an Earth-like globe, they would both have to be in the northern hemisphere to account for the climate differences. Dorne, for example, would have to be situated at or around the equator to justify its continually warm climate, even in the winter. To make a comparison, the southernmost tip of South America, Cape Horn, can get very cold at times due to its proximity and Antarctica. Yeah, that can't be true. I was taught that South America was hot.
All of South America. All of the massive continent.
All of Africa is also similarly a jungle, I'm pretty sure.
It's called Antarcticos.
Antarcticos.
And it's a genderless nation of apparently penguins.
Imp penguins.
We've established this. Have you not been listening?
Yes. You should have listened to this podcast in the future and not wrote into this. So I got two observations. Number one, you can get in a lot of trouble applying science to this world because George has explicitly said that the seasons are magical. They're not a result of some complicated astrophysics, three sun orbiting around a fifth sun, gets a little too close and now it's hot. It's all magic.
Okay. Which is his way to say, I don't want to do the research into what it would take to make these seasons make sense.
Take that shit to Ray Bradbury or Isaac Asimov. I'm just trying to write a yarn here.
Which is fine.
Yeah. There is actually a land south of Westeros. You'll never guess what it's called. It's called Southeros.
Get out of here.
I'm not making
Fuck
it up.
Fuck you, man. No way.
Well, I mean, is it weird that we got a North and South America? Like, no. What, you fucking ran out of names?
No, it's not.
Like, I mean, it's...
Is there... I guess Essos is supposed to be Easteros?
Or maybe Os is the word for land, and Western land just means... It's like, probably just means Western lands, Eastern lands, and South lands.
Where's
like,
the Northos?
That is the lands of Always Winter. They broke their mold there. Because I think it's one piece of contiguous land, like Westeros. There's nothing north of Westeros to lick the continent. I don't know.
They call the whole thing Planetos, so it's stupid.
Right, and that's
I don't know if the books like, do, but the fans do.
Yeah, the Martin doesn't like that. His preferred thing is like they would call their planet the same thing. Like we call Earth essentially dirt, and that's like he essentially feels that they would whatever the Westeros like they would call it the. You know, whatever version of soil that they hold to. But there, yeah, so like it does, even despite all those caveats, it does seem to follow that where the north, farther north you go, it gets colder. The farther south you go, it gets warmer. The southern isles are very warm. But then no one knows, like, this is very early on, like there is no one that's sailing around the globe and making like precise. So there might be some. Maybe it does get eventually cold and you go down south, but you don't know. And also, it's magic.
Yeah,
there could be turtles all the way down. It's just you get down to south of Southeros and it's just turtlos until you get to the very bottom. So it's hard to answer those with any kind of precision because there's no scientific precision to be had. Double T from Melbourne. About the Mormons, why did Yor join the Night Watch? Why did Alistair Thorne, for that matter? I think I heard this was due to his Targaryen allegiances during Robert's Rebellion, but I thought Robert pardoned Targaryen loyalists when they came back to power. For that matter, why didn't Jorah take the Black rather than flee Westeros? He's a Northman. They generally hold the Night's Watch in high regard, and his father was there. Well, reading between the lines, I think his father was there the big reason Jorah didn't take the Black.
Okay.
He fled to Essos because he still had his wife with him, and he clearly loved his wife more than his own honor. She left him in Essos, and then, what, he's going to go back and face his... He's a proud man. He's going to face his father, who's the Lord Commander of the Night's Watch. That would be fun.
Yeah, he'd be a steward for sure.
I mean, that's the thing. Like, Jorah is not a great guy. Mm-hmm. We like him because And you could usefully compare and contrast his behavior when he's married to his wife, where he would do anything for her to make her happy. And when he ran out of money, he started selling slaves, like with his kind of obsessive love of Daenerys. So, like, he's hitched his wagon to maybe a more worthy cause, but he's still
loyal,
the same
but not
kind
very
of guy.
Principled kind of person.
Yeah. Like, if Dany told him to slit a babe's throat, I don't know that he would have a problem with it.
Yeah. He's been hanging out with the Dothraki for too long.
Yeah, and if he did, his love for her would probably sort it all out.
Right.
About Jor, that's the tragedy of Jor is he took the Night's Watch when he became old and his son became of age because he wanted to make, you know, he wanted Jorah to be able to kind of have room to fly. So he took, I'm old and I'm not going to go lead this house to my, you know, as a dotard. I'm going to go to the Night's Watch where I can do some good and Jorah will take over the house. And then he fucked it up. Alistair Thorne is so you're right. When Robert came back to King's Landing, he made peace with a lot of the enemies. The key word is when he got back, because he was grievously wounded in his duel with fuck-faced Targaryen. That's not his name.
Sure.
First of his line. Shit. Rhaegar. No. Yeah. Rhaegar.
Sounds right.
he got in his duel at the Trident. So he was recovering from his wounds, and Tywin was kind of dispensing justice because he was a late turncoat, and he offered the loyalists the option to go to the Black or die. And Sir Alistair took the probably one of the many reasons he's bitter is like, God damn it! If I was out of King's Landing at the time, I could have taken a sweet pardon deal and still be an important part of my house. So, That's it. That's non the feed, spoiler feedback.
Oh, okay.
I hope I didn't fuck up any of those historical details. I tried doing a research, but I wouldn't surprise if I got sudden. Some of those things were opinion too, like all that shit about the geography. That's all opinion. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I would like to know if I was wrong. You can send those complaints to me at gameofthrones@baldmove.com, or praise, or your own comments. Whatever. It doesn't have to be criticism. It's nice when it's not. But I understand. Sometimes I need to get the Greyjoy Smackdown. And you can also follow our fellow fans and their theories and speculation at forums.baldmove.com, and follow us on all the social medias @or/baldmove.
Yeah. We are going to have some spoilery things to talk about. We probably have some spoilery feedback.
We will.
We don't have any music to interrupt you, to remind you that, hey, we're going into the spoiler section. So let this be your reminder. We're going into the spoiler section now.
Shut it off.
Yeah, if you don't want to hear it, get out of here, and we'll see you next week. If you do want to hear it, join us in just a second. And we're back with the spoilers. I have a couple of things I wanted to talk about.
Okay, because I really didn't. I didn't have a lot of... stuff that jumped out at me.
Well, watching through this, I guess, third time now, what really stuck out to me is Marjorie and her character and her she really seemed to be caught up in this fight between Brienne and Loras. And I don't know if it was simply because her brother was involved or she's trying to put on a show here for the crowds who are gathered, but kind of cast a different light on her relationship with Joffrey a little bit. Like, I know she's leaning into, like, whatever pleases the king. She's leaning into it, but how much of that is, you know, displeasing to her, and how much of that does she enjoy? Like, when she's fingering this crossbow with Joffrey here in a couple seasons, or maybe next season, how against that is Marjorie, really?
That's a good question. I mean, yeah,
her attitude toward it just surprised me.
That shows it does. Like, I think you're on to something, because as I said in the main podcast, they are trying to show a similarity between how she views blood as a necessary and maybe even exciting part of this Game of Thrones.
Right.
Whereas Renly likes to pretend that that part of it doesn't exist. If he just glad hands people and remembers their name and the fact that they've hurt their foot, then he can ride that to the Iron Throne.
Uh huh.
So yeah, you might be onto something there.
I don't know. I'll have to, I guess, when we get to that part again, because I think it's next season.
I definitely think later statements she makes, she's not very impressed with Joffrey. But she
For sure. But maybe not for the same, for the reasons that I think.
Yeah. Okay.
And also, she's very manipulative. And
yes.
And maybe I'm just misreading it.
Yes.
I also had forgotten, and I think you alluded to this a little bit, probably a lot of people forgot, where Arya got this idea for her list of names.
Yeah.
Which comes from Yorin. I didn't remember that.
Yeah.
So if you're like me, that was probably a treat.
That's what I said, like the oft-forgotten Yorin, but she got one of her defining trademarks, her prayer structure from him.
Yeah, I thought that was a nice little reminder. And that's pretty much it as far as original thoughts. Do the listeners have some thoughts?
I do. Also, like, I think that's the exciting. One of the, we never talked about this in our preview, but one of the exciting things about this season is, and one of the smarter edits they've made to Game of Thrones is when Arya gets taken to Harrenhal. Of course, that's where Tywin Lannister is using his command post, and he takes her as his kind of like page boy. And Tywin Lannister is one of Arya's mentors.
Yeah,
like she learns a lot from watching him, which I think is kind of cool because he's another one that you don't think of, because then she's going to hook up with Jaqen and then the Hound, and like those are so larger than life characters and arcs that these guys get lost in a shuffle. But
and you can really see the influences from all those people on her personality later on.
Yes, indeed. But yeah, we do have feedback. GameofThrones@baldmove.com. Joe, I was just thinking about how you guys said that you thought the remaining books would leave the quote-unquote power players and overall events in the same order as the show. But is that really possible anymore? A few key distinctions seem to make it unlikely. First of all, assuming the Aegon, the blue-haired one planted by Varys, is Aegon, is there any way Jon's plotline follows the same trajectory? Wouldn't there be two characters with very similar roles and goals in the same place in the same time? Not to mention two characters with literally the same name. And while that's super important, the much more prolific use of warging in the book seems like it could be a major subplot that could drive some forces in other directions. The other major wild card to me is Lady Stoneheart. While we've gotten very little of her, the simple fact is she seems super relevant. If she succeeds in just a few of her goals to avenge her house, then the Lannisters will be thoroughly changed plot-wise. If I remember right, she should have all the Lannisters on her kill list, and even if one of them dies in the book and the show, that would have to diverge drastically. What do you guys think about all this? I don't know about the Lady Stoneheart plot, because I think that if all of her plans come to fruition, what's going to happen is she, with the Brotherhood Without Banners, is going to destroy the Freys and the Boltons. Hmm. And that has come to pass in the show. And it's been like the hands of Jon and Arya. So you're right. And I guess when I say power players, I'm talking about Jon and Dany and Cersei and Jaime and Arya. Like, I don't throw fake Aegon in there. And that definitely reveals some of my bias, right? Because I think that the fake Aegon is going to be a distraction and is going to be a red herring. And to the extent that he's important, like whatever strife is between him and Dany is supposed to exist in the books, it seems like they're going to try to put a little bit of that between Jon and Dany. And maybe that's why Jon has the name Aegon when a lot of people don't like it. I would be shocked if with the Winds of Winter and the Dream of Spring comes out and fake Aegon is actually Aegon and he is a big part of the books. Like, you would look back and say he's a power player. Like, is Prince Doran a power player? In the books, you might say it is, but if his plot goes nowhere, which it kind of already has, then he was a potential power player that didn't make it. Well, would you say Renly's a power player?
Right.
This season, you sure as shit would, but looking out over the entire history of the, like, no, probably not.
Yeah, or Stannis, for that matter, you know? It's
exactly.
Like, they're storylines that have come to an end, I guess. And, you know, if, for power players, I would throw the Night King in there.
Yeah, yeah,
obviously,
sure.
Like that whole Others Force is going to be, I imagine, roughly track with what the books do.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. Like, there could be room for shocks because there's nothing that says George has to. There's nothing that says the Double D's have to be faithful to all of his bullet points, and there's certainly nothing that says that George would have to commit to bullet points he's given them.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it would shock me if, like, Jaime strangles Cersei in the books and Tyrion strangles her on the show. It would be shocking to me if Dany kills the Night King in the show and Jon kills him in the books.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just, to me, like, they've certainly got bullet points that big, and why the hell would they not go through with it?
Yeah.
Because the other thing is, like, if they didn't want to go through with it, there's probably a tighter way to write this if they just want to start making whatever shit they wanted up. So, like, why, you know. But that's my biases. It's not necessarily right or wrong. It's just,
I mean, I'm prepared to be shocked.
Yeah.
I don't think it has to go that way.
But I think it would be a shock. Like, if
but it would be shocking,
like,
yeah.
One of those things is established and the books contradict it, mm-hmm. it will be talked about a lot. And the fandom as a shocking thing that's happened.
For sure.
And then people will debate about whether George always wanted it that way and whether he changed his mind or the Double D. Like, there's going to be so much fucking nerd holy wars over this.
Pretty much no matter what happens.
Yeah.
Because there are going to be differences.
George not finishing the books before the series is Jon Arryn being poisoned in the Red Keep. Like, it's the thing that's going to start a bunch of nerd blood spilled on the internets for decades to come. Josh L. from Denver. I want to weigh on the Arya and Gendry relationship. I certainly doubt Gendry ever thought of Arya as anything other than a friend or little sister. For Arya's part, though, there is a couple of scenes where they implied Arya's approach to puberty and thinking about boys in a new way. For a few episodes, when we reach the Ghost of Harrenhal, Arya certainly appears to be getting an eyeful of Gendry's shirtless, muscled torso as he's forging a sword in the moments before the Tickler's death, perhaps crushing a bit on her blue-eyed companion. The other scene I wanted to bring up comes in Season 3, the episode Kissed by Fire, and does depend on the directorial intent. If you recall, in that episode, Gendry tells Arya that he's planning on joining the Brotherhood, much to Arya's dismay. When he notes the Brotherhood is like a family and that he's never had a family, she replies, "I can be your family." The director of that episode, Alex Graves, said in the behind-the-scenes interviews that he had Maisie read several takes for that line, and then the one he went with was the one he felt sounded close to the declaration of, "I love you." So it's possible that in a pre-Hound, pre-Red Wedding, pre-Braavos Aria had something of a girlhood crush on Gendry and certainly cared enough about him to temporarily add Melisandre, Beric, and Thoros to her list when Mel took him away. That said, of course, she's a very different person now. It's about as hard for me to imagine Arya initiating a romance with anyone at this point as Bran doing the same. Yeah. I thought this was, and I had no idea this was about Alex Graves. Of course, Alex Graves is also famous for shooting a scene where Jaime rapes Cersei and the Sept of Baelor it wasn't a rape. It wasn't supposed to be seen as a rape. So
yeah,
it gets really, really odd when you're talking about directorial intent with him. But I thought it's interesting that he tried to choose one that made it as close to I love you. And then, like, what does I love you mean? I love you like a brother. I love, you know.
Yeah.
But I thought that was pretty interesting. Any other comments, or should we move on?
No, let's go ahead.
Nicholas P., upon rewatching season 3, holy shit, you're getting ahead of us.
Yeah.
Slow down, man. Craster Bosey has 99 sons. Does this, and a bitch, and a bitch ain't one.
Yeah, well, duh. That to John's face. How could it be? Insulting, yeah.
Does this mean they're 99 or 96 minus the ones that have been killed, White Walkers? We've only seen a few at a time. I mean,
I don't know that he's meant to be taken literally, right?
Yeah.
Has he kept count? Does he have the records?
Like, if he's in the
let me see your children books.
Like, Martin says half a hundred all the time as his way of saying essentially countless, or like, lot, I've got a couple, you know, time out of mind. It's kind of like that. Like, I don't think it's literally true. He's got notches that he's been keeping track of, but who knows?
He doesn't seem like a guy who would keep track of that.
Right. Also, it's been said that dragon blood is required for dragon riding. Does this mean the Night King has dragon blood in him? I don't think so, because the Targaryens came to Westeros a long time after the Children of the Forest beefed with the First Men. And also, a lot of that's just Targaryen bullshit.
Right.
Like, the fact that they're immune to fire, and like and again, Dany's the glaring exception to that, but a lot of this stuff is just Targaryen propaganda and mystique. They didn't want to think anybody could give a sugar cube to a dragon and hop on it and they'd be cool.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you just were like kind to a dragon, that they would be cool with you. I do think that this has a lot of currency in the fandom. There's a lot of theories based solely on who and does and does not have dragon blood, and they got to be the ones that ride the dragon. So I'm not being dismissive of it. I'm just saying that, first of all, like, I think that whatever the dragon nature that Viserion had is probably gone after he's been whited.
Yeah.
Like, that's got to fundamentally change your what you see and is and is not of a dragon, you know?
Yeah, I would think so.
So,
I mean, it fundamentally changed what he breathes.
Right.
So,
and how fast he is, and how many holes he's got in his wings. There's a lot, and the color of his eye.
Yep.
The other thing about the Craster and the 99 Sons is, like, Craster's just a man. Like, I think I've always been of the opinion that Craster is the last of the ones that are keeping, like he sees himself as this holy man, and he's the last to kind of keep this arrangement with the Night's Watch, or with the Night King, which kind of implies that others might have in the past. And that's a popular fan theory. The reason that the others are getting restless is because man has largely stopped honoring their agreement to help them reproduce.
Yeah.
But that's just a theory. And, you know, like I said, if they just had the original, like the Night King, and he's just waiting for Craster for 8,000 years to give him recruits, maybe that's why he's marching. Fucking Craster. It was just Night King up there brooding about, like, how everything went wrong. And then Craster started leaving babies on his doorstep. And he's like, fuck, I got an army now.
Like, setting out a welcome mat?
It's bad idea, Craster.
Yeah.
Bad idea. He's the king of bad ideas.
He is.
Rebecca F., you guys said something in a previous podcast about Sansa and Tyrion ending up together with the caveat of Sansa being the one to suggest it. If that happens, what do you think about Tyrion suggesting they take the Stark name? He hates being a Lannister, and with Bran already stating he won't be Lord of Winterfell, and Jon being a Targaryen, this could be a way to continue the line. It also follows with the more progressive route they've been going. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm down with that.
Is that, I mean, I always think of, like, in terms of progressiveness, I'm like, is that too progressive for this society?
Oh, the Game of Thrones society? Maybe.
Yeah, like Tyrion declaring that he has no house anymore and he marries into House Stark. Like, I like that idea, but would that be something everyone snickers at court?
Snickers? He doesn't need...
Snicker or snicker. I think you can do either one.
Sure.
You can snicker at my use of snigger. I don't know.
All right. I feel like he's already got a lot of things for people to take jabs at.
That's true.
He might not want to add one more to the list.
That's true.
But I mean, it sort of feels right from my modern day perspective.
Yeah.
Like, let Sansa be the power player here. You've had your chance. You kind of fucked it all up. And you're kind of lucky to get what you have at that point.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. Like, the bastards and broken things, crippled bastards and broken things, tend to be more progressive than most because they're not part of the entrenched power structure.
Right.
Like, you can't say the word entrenched power structure with also saying that, like, there's degrees of liberalism and conservatives among the wealthy and the powerful and elite, but that is by nature a conservative, like, an establishment is conservative by nature. So yeah, it would make sense for him to be a little bit more idealistic and broad-minded than, say, his father or sister.
Mm-hmm.
So I like it. I like it, and I think Sansa and Tyrion are a good match. It's just Sansa might have other options, and I feel like Sansa deserves to get whatever the fuck she wants at the end of all this.
Yeah,
Kyle Y. The season 2 opening episode featured Stannis and Melisandre with a fake Lightbringer sword during the beach burning scene. As you mentioned during the podcast, the entire ceremony seems staged and ridiculous. It seems strange that Lightbringer hasn't been referenced since this episode, despite the many referrals to Azor Ahai, the prince that was promised, etc., throughout the books or swords. I think that all ingredients are technically on screen for Lightbringer, but I'm not sure if they would be as satisfying to a TV audience. Jon Snow as a badass swordsman, Sam Tarly uncovering Valyrian steel's secret formula, Gendry as a blacksmith to forge the sword, use of flaming swords throughout the series, but Lightbringer being the ultimate form, the romantic relationship between Jon and Dany could mirror Azor Ahai and Nissa, Melisandre going back to Essos to discover some ancient spell or scroll, also dying as a possible Nissa candidate. Do you think there's any role for a literal magic sword as Lightbringer during the final moments of season 8?
Sure, I think so.
I'll say the same thing because someone asked me this at one of the Con of Throne presentations we did, and I said, the problem I have with Lightbringer is I just can't see how you visualize it.
Like a fiery sword?
Like Aragorn had a magic sword in Lord of the Rings, and so did Gandalf. And whenever you saw it on screen, it's pretty much just a regular old sword. There was nothing like it. What was special about it is, I guess, the man who wielded it.
Hmm.
And, you know, it was a storied blade and everybody respected. And Valyrian steel, it's like, where, other than the fact that it can smash White Walkers, like, how can it be better than light? Like, what would Lightbringer be better at? It touches a White Walker and explodes in the glass shards.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, the idea of, like, John, like, raising it on high, like, fucking He-Man's sword and, like, smiting them all the beam of light, or, like, Sauron in the first of Lord of the Rings where he's just swinging his mace and 100 dudes go flying. Like, that just seems ridiculous.
Uh-huh.
So
maybe it's more like a Zelda thing. Maybe he can shoot swords out of his sword.
He can shoot light swords out of his swords if he has the magic. If he's got all of his heart containers filled, that seems,
which he does now that he's banging Dany. He's got them all filled up.
Nah, baby, that see this hole over my heart. It just all that love just leaks out. I'm a rolling stone, Dany. I can't kneel. I just think I don't think Lightbringer as a magic sword makes sense. I think.
No?
Okay. I think you'll find that Lightbringer is going to be the person. Like, John is Lightbringer, or Dany might be Lightbringer. But it's something that's the legend then, you know, came in and did a whole bunch of, you know, Paul Bunyan bullshit with it. But the essential truth is someone took a stand, and that was the important thing. That's just my opinion.
Okay.
And if you think that there'd be a way to have, like, you know, Lightbringer shooting out magic lightning bolts or something, and it would feel like Game of Thrones, then by all means email. I mean, I guess you could also say, well, the flying dragons inserting armies feel like Game of Thrones before the season.
I mean, that's the thing. I don't know how they'll do it, but I don't think I'm going to roll my eyes if I see a magic sword done well.
Interesting.
Like, because look at Beric's sword, right? So like, Beric's sword is flaming. That's pretty sweet looking.
Yeah.
I never, like, rolled my eyes and said, oh, God, a flaming sword. What the fuck?
Mm-hmm.
Just crank that up a notch. I don't know what it looks like, but show me something cool and I'll be on board.
I mean, like I'm trying to think, like, maybe it just is, like looks like a fusion reaction, like it just bursting with heat and
fire. A lightsaber?
Like a lightsaber, exactly. Is that, like, he already has a weapon that cuts through these things like butter anyway.
Right.
Like, he just barely has to scratch them and they die. It's like, that's a visually cooler looking thing, but is it more effective? I don't know. Maybe it just has to visually look cool. It has to tell people that this guy is Azor Ahai, goddammit, or Danny is, or somebody.
It could be a symbolic thing, right? Yeah. It's not necessarily that the sword has better, like, physical powers, but it could just be a symbol of John's status, I guess.
Yeah, it's like the saints that always paint him with halos, so you know who's the good guys.
Uh-huh.
That will be whoever is Azor Ahai is going to be their halo. But yeah, I'd like to know other people's opinions on that. That's just mine. And you can send those opinions to GameOfThrones@BaldMove.com. Again, we got the forums@BaldMove.com and all the social medias @/BaldMove. We'll be back for the fourth episode next week.
Mm-hmm.
Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.